This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Dead Daughter by Anna Celeste Burke, narrated by Rebecca Mitchell. Prologue. Jessica used her bound hands to tug at the jacket she was wearing. Keeping it closed retained more of her body heat. With her hands under the edge of the jacket, she worked to loosen the rope wrapped around her wrists. Seated, with her back pressed against an outcropping of boulders near one of the scenic overlooks on the Desert View Trail, she could see much of the Coachella Valley. The spectacle below was breathtaking, a view she'd always loved, but not now. Overlaid by a gridwork of roadways and buildings, colorful patches stood out in contrast to swaths of white desert sand. The lights in the desert resort cities below sparkled as the day languished and evening approached. It got dark so early this time of year. The air was crisp and fragrant with the smell of pine trees that flourished in the Mount San Jacinto wilderness at the top of the Palm Springs Tramway. Jessica had come here many times while growing up in the valley below. She loved the short tram ride that carried you from palms to pines in minutes. This trip was her first visit since returning to the Palm Springs area after retreating to her childhood home in the wake of unfortunate events that had wreaked havoc on her well-planned life. Despite her best efforts to take refuge behind the gates of the Tony Mission Hills Country Club in Rancho Mirage, calamity prevailed. Jessica had soon fought like a junkyard dog to survive a series of shocking attacks. Not even an earthly paradise could keep murder and mayhem at bay. Now, here she was again, this time in the company of another wealthy, pampered, 30-something woman whose life was in tatters. Libby Vanderwert had a gun and was in the midst of a full-blown manic episode. "Please listen to me. It's getting cold and dark. Let's go inside where it's warm and talk this over. We'll get coffee and talk as long as you want." The ties give as Jessica repeatedly picked at the knots and then stretched, clenched, and unclenched her bound wrists. She had been working on them since she sat down on the flat-topped boulder. Wiggle room meant she was making progress. An icy blast made her work harder. They'd followed the trail away from the visitor center at the top of the tramway after Libby stuck a gun in Jessica's ribs. When they arrived at the overlook, Libby had bound Jessica's hands and forced her to sit on the ground. "No, you're trying to trick me. If I go back, the police will arrest me. My screwed-up life will get even worse. Do you think I want to spend what's left of it in prison?" "I'll help you. Nobody wants you to spend the rest of your life locked up." "Oh, yeah? They think I killed Shannon. Why not, since I've lied to everyone over and over? Now, thanks to you, they can add kidnapping to my rap sheet. I've had plenty of help from you, Jessica Huntington. If you had followed me when I asked you to, I wouldn't have had to use the gun." Libby hopped from one huge boulder to another, getting closer to where Jessica sat. A wave of vertigo swept over Jessica. It looked as though Libby hovered above a sheer drop into the valley. That image was deceptive. The land fell away at a slope, not visible from where she sat. That didn't mean that falling from where the hyped-up young woman stood now wouldn't hurt. It might even kill her. "Untie my hands. Let's go back to the tram station while we still can without breaking our necks. It's going to get icy when the sun sets. If anyone asks, I'll explain that this was a big misunderstanding. There won't be any charges filed against you for kidnapping, I promise. We'll find someone else to help you if you don't want me to be involved." "I've already got help. I've had help since I was 12. Dr. Dick is just the latest in a long line of shrinks. He used me, but I let him do it. He believed me, Jessica. Anything I said, and the grimier, the better. It was such a rush, you know, making up all this sick stuff about people. I had it all worked out. With a little help from my respected shrink, I'd pay back the smug jerks for everything they had ever done to me." As she spoke, Libby paced along the top of a row of boulders. She pretended to be walking on a tightrope, wobbling like she might lose her balance. That started another wave of vertigo, forcing Jessica to shut her eyes as she worked harder at the rope around her wrists. "You should have seen how he worked me. He nodded with such concern in his eyes and spoke with so much admiration for all I'd suffered. In fact, he was so sorry that I almost believed it myself. I even cried real tears. It was nothing but lies and more lies about my family. That's slander or libel or some crap like that, right? She abruptly stopped pacing and almost lost her balance. Oh my God, Libby, no! Jessica gasped. Libby steadied herself and picked up where she'd left off. A wistful note entered her voice for a moment. I thought he loved me. I figured that if I forced my parents to give me my inheritance early, I could run off with the love of my life. Why not? If I waited until they died to get the money, I'd be too old to enjoy it anyway. That part was his idea. Getting the money, I mean. I'm the one who tried to get it for him, though. So add extortion to slander and libel and kidnapping. Whatever. She shrugged and went back to her pretend high-wire act. That she had help from Dr. Richard Carr while hatching her scheme to harass her parents was news to Jessica, who knew how much of what Libby was saying bore any resemblance to truth, rather than more lies or delusions. I'm not the first, but I will be the last psycho tramp who falls for Dr. Dick. I pulled a Monica Lewinsky on him with enough of his DNA to make sure he never practices psychotherapy again. That's one thing I wanted to tell you when I asked you to meet me up here. It's all in a little blue bag, Jessica. Get it and use what's in it so I won't be a dead daughter for nothing. She threw her head back and laughed, made a sudden turn like she was a gymnast reaching the end of a balance beam, and walked back. That dead daughter statement and the routine that followed sent a chill down Jessica's spine that had nothing to do with the temperature up there at 8,000 feet. Libby, I'm sorry Dr. Carr took advantage of you. Why wait? Let's go get him, now! DNA evidence was one way to sort fact from fiction. If he was taking advantage of his clients, perhaps the renowned psychiatrist had planted the seeds of false allegations in the confused woman's head, too. What's wrong with you? I broke my family. Don't you get it? Or doesn't that mean anything to you? With that, she stopped and hopped down closer to Jessica with a menacing gleam in her eye. I care about my family, Jessica said. I also understand how much trouble you can get into when you're angry and confused. Lots of us get in over our heads and hurt people, even the ones we love the most. Jessica felt the ropes on her wrist give again as she spoke those words to Libby in a calm voice. Only a little more and she could slip free. What to do after that wasn't clear. The gun Libby held wasn't more than a few inches away. Shut up! You don't know what you're talking about, except the part about being in over your head. It's over for me, like it was for my so-called friend, Shannon Donnelly. I'm the one who told them what she was up to. Dr. Dick and that red devil, too. It's my fault she's gone. I'm going to pay for that, one way or another. Here's an idea. Why don't I take you with me? I'll make you disappear, too. Poof! Libby waved the gun back and forth over Jessica, as if it were a magic wand. Her face was pale. Her dark eyes were wild, and her hair flowed in the cold mountain air. She was like a character from Harry Potter, a mad wizard in training. You should have left me alone. You called me, remember? I'm here because you reached out for help. Please, no more dead daughters, okay? Get rid of that gun. Toss it down below, and nobody will know you even had a gun. You don't want to hurt me, yourself, or anyone else. I can help you. Paul can help you, too. Libby squatted down, fixing Jessica with a grimace on her lips. Are you kidding me? Like he did when I had that car accident that killed Leela, you mean? Please don't tell me you believe that was an accident. I should have died, too, you moron. You aren't half as smart as you think you are. Libby stood up again and turned her back on Jessica. Paul Worthington was helpful, all right. All he did was let me get up to more mischief. That's what I've done, you know. Caused a lot of mischief for Leela and Shannon and my oh-so-respectable family. Libby tossed her head back and cackled. The action caused her to wobble again. My parents' lives are blown to bits. Such accomplished people with their rags-to-riches story and all that overcoming hardship garbage. No matter what else they ever do, they're losers as parents. If I haven't already made that clear, I will soon, won't I? Come on, Libby. I can't believe you want that for them or for you. There's always a chance to make things right. You just have to give it another try. Oh, no. Not that old try and try again line. At a time like this, is that all you've got? Woo-hoo! It's a long way down. Come look. With that, Libby climbed back to the boulder she'd been using as a balance beam and took a couple of steps back without even looking. Stop! Don't back up anymore. You're so close to the edge already. You've got to believe me. These rocks get slippery. Come here now, or I'll shoot you. Libby pointed the gun at Jessica. Then what? Who will help you make sure Carr pays for what he's done to you? Go ahead and shoot me, because I'm not coming any closer.
Do as she says, Miss Huntington, or I'll do it.
Jessica's head snapped around, startled by the sound. There he was, on another of the nearby boulders, as if he had been conjured up out of thin air by Libby's words. The doctor's white hair gleamed in the afternoon sunlight. Dr. Richard Carr was waving a gun of his own. Jessica was about to warn him off when Carr, belying his age, moved toward her in a flash. He hopped from the boulder he was on to another, and then down onto a flat rocky area near where Jessica sat. Grabbing her by the ropes, he jerked her to her feet.
Libby has the right idea about you. You haven't been helpful to her at all. In fact, you've been a pain in the neck from day one. She'd be fine right now if you'd kept your mouth shut tight around that silver spoon in it. It is a pity you two couldn't help each other, though. Under other circumstances, you might have been close friends. Two self-absorbed, poor little rich girls, with no real worries in your pointless little lives, you could have found plenty to whine about over manis and petties. You and all the rest of the entitled children in my practice make me sick. What a bunch of naive, sheltered, self-centered monsters. Easy to manipulate, I will say that much for Libby, especially with the help of my liberal drug policy. She was fine until you stepped in. Now get up there, or I'll shoot her and then you.
He motioned with the gun toward Libby.
It won't work, Carr. They'll figure out you did it.
How?
Nobody even knows I'm up here. It'll be easy enough to believe you two psychos fought over the gun or something. Or maybe you decided you were Rodeo Drive's answer to Thelma and Louise and forged a murder-suicide pact. Who knows? There's ample evidence you're no more stable than Libby. You've been in treatment for years, with one therapist after another. Then a nasty divorce and all the other traumas you've been through in the last few months. It's enough to push anyone over the edge. Over the edge. Get it?
Carr laughed at that last witty bit. His laugh was as unnerving as those that had issued from Libby earlier. Libby wasn't laughing now.
How do you know I've been in treatment? Or why?
Too wound up to answer, he continued his rant.
I can't believe you had the gall to get Libby to turn on me. And you, Libby, are sicker and dumber than I ever dreamed. Why don't you do as Miss Huntington suggested and toss the gun down below? Trust me. If you make even the slightest move, I'll shoot your meddlesome friend. I know you don't want another dead daughter on your conscience, now that you seem to have found one.
Jessica stood, letting the new psychopath take his turn raging against the fates. His yank on the ropes had brought her to her feet, but had also loosened them enough so that she could wriggle free as the madman spoke. In an instant, she reached over and shoved him. Caught by surprise, he went flailing backward. He slipped off the boulder and fell flat on his back with an audible thud and a grunt of pain. The gun flew out of his hands and wedged into a nearby crevice. Jessica scrambled up onto the boulder where Libby stood, grabbed her by the hand, and yanked her toward the jumble of rocks they needed to cross to get to safety.
"Let's go. This ends now. We're going to tell the authorities all about your esteemed psychiatrist. He'll never hurt you or anyone else again."
As they moved past the spot where the doctor had fallen, he climbed on the rocks behind them. He reached for Libby, who teetered as she tried to evade his grasp. Libby shoved Jessica and then turned away as the man lunged for her. Dr. Carr grabbed hold of Libby's arm and pulled himself forward onto the boulder with her. She still had that gun in her hand as they all struggled to maintain their footing. Jessica heard two sounds, a gunshot and a blood-curdling scream. The scream was her own as she plunged into nothingness. Maybe it was a sheer drop to the valley below.
1. The ICU. The room was cool and dark in the eerie twilight of the intensive care unit where they had brought Jessica.
It was quiet, except for a soft, rhythmic pinging and the whooshing sound of a machine hooked up to her. To her anxious mother, the room gave off a strange vibe, cocoon-like. Everything suspended in time and place, a way station on the too thin line between this life and the next. What came next was unclear, but oblivion played a big part in Alexis's notions of the afterlife. Oblivion was a blessing when life asked too much, like now, when she was worried sick about her daughter. The wish for oblivion was for herself, not for Jessica, who had barely missed an early entry into the netherworld hours earlier. Alexis sat in a chair next to the hospital bed. She'd been there all night. A rescue team had found Jessica alive, and they lifted her off the ledge where she had fallen and transported her by helicopter for trauma care. She was in good shape, given her fall and hours of exposure to the elements near the peak of Mount San Jacinto. It was below freezing by the time rescuers reached her. Her daughter wasn't out of the woods yet. Well, she was literally out of the woods, but hadn't received the all-clear in terms of her prognosis. She dropped 20 feet before hitting that ledge. Alexis tried not to think about what would have happened if that granite outcropping hadn't been there. Another member of Jessica's party missed the ledge and found oblivion. The room felt cold. Alexis rubbed her hands together to warm them and shake off the what-if chills. Jessica was also fortunate to have landed in the piles of accumulated leaves, pine needles, and other debris that cushioned her fall. She'd sustained cuts and bruises in various places on her body, including scrapes on her face. The most serious cut, on the palm of her left hand, must have occurred when she grabbed something as she fell. That cut, a deep slice almost to the bone, had been cemented with medical-grade superglue before bandaging. She had bruised, but not broken, ribs on the left side of her body, which absorbed most of the impact of the fall. Her left shoulder, slammed hard, was also bruised. The doctor described a broken bone in her left arm as a clean break, whatever that meant. "That part of your daughter's anatomy will soon be as good as new," the baby-faced doctor had assured Alexis, smiling as he spoke. Alexis wanted to punch him. He was trying to be upbeat, but something about him grated her. Perhaps his bedside manner bore a hint of condescension that the young too often displayed toward their elders, even filthy rich elders who could buy them several times over. She fiddled with the showy diamond ring on her finger. She still wore it, even though she'd removed the matching wedding band Giovanni had given her. Or maybe it was just a doctor thing, a god complex running amok. In the last few months, she'd had more than her share of heart-to-hearts with doctors. So many well-regarded specialists in their fields, most of them were older men, women still far and few between. The young nerds learning to ply their trade weren't any better than the well-established older gents. Many couldn't even make eye contact if they had to ask sensitive questions or deliver bad news. Where were the doctors like the one she knew in childhood? The Baldwin family doctor didn't have to ask what killed your grandmother because he already knew. All dead, and if not, a dying breed for sure, like their longtime family doctor, may he rest in peace. These days, it was a, "McDoctor, can I take your order, please?" experience, without the please. Even the so-called concierge medicine she paid for helped little. Despite all the hype, it seemed more like a way to collect extra fees than a means to provide more exclusive, patient-oriented care, like good old Marcus Welby. Marcus Welby, right, Alexis thought, as the doctor next to her pored over Jessica's chart that was displayed on an electronic device. "You are showing your age, Alexis, my dear. That's most unbecoming of a lady and a Baldwin." Her mother's voice popped up on a tape in her head. Alexis needed to shut Mum up to hear the doctor. It was already after midnight, and she wanted to call Hank to tell him about their daughter's mishap. And she wanted to get back to Jessica. The Xanax she'd taken to calm her nerves wasn't doing any good. "How long before I can take another?" Alexis wondered, as she struggled to focus on what this annoying little man said. "We're still concerned about the nasty bump on her head. A scan revealed no evidence of any internal bruising or bleeding, but she was out cold when the EMTs got to her. She could talk to us when they first brought her in, knew who she was, what day it was, things like that. We needed to patch her up and set that bone in her arm, and she was in pain, so we sedated her. The plan is to keep her in the ICU overnight, where we can control the pain and watch her to ensure we haven't missed anything. That smug smile appeared again. Peering from over the rim of his glasses, the resemblance to a nerdy 12-year-old was even more pronounced. If he reaches out to pat me on the head or calls me honey, he's getting an elbow or a foot in a place he'll not soon forget, Alexis thought, as she smiled and listened. Jessica's vital signs returned to normal once the EMTs reached her. If they stay that way, we'll move her out of the ICU in the morning. Unless a new problem pops up, she should be able to go home in another day or two. Relief swamped Alexis, hearing that optimistic punchline to the doctor's report. Moments later, Alexis relayed what she'd learned to Henry Hank Huntington, her ex-husband, Jessica's father. She was sorry to have to call him so late and with bad news. Still, she was grateful not to have to tell him he had a dead daughter. The possibility had loomed large in her mind as she and Bernadette sped from Mission Hills to the hospital. It was a short drive with Bernadette at the wheel of the Escalade. Alexis, too shaken to drive, had already taken an Ambien. Not that one Ambien knocked her out these days, but why chance driving when Bernadette was at the ready? And she'd taken several other pills as she prepared to retire for the night, so better safe than sorry. "Why do you suppose no one called us earlier? It sounds like this began hours ago," Alexis wondered aloud. "That's what I wanted to know when Don Fontana called us. I was ready to give him a chunk of my mind for not telling us right away that Jessica was in trouble. He said his department hadn't heard about it right away either, Alexis. At first, the Rangers thought it was stranded hikers. You know, that happens all the time around here. Those mountains are crawling with people, even this time of year when it's cold up there." "Sure. The tramway counts on holiday traffic to tide them over until the season gets underway." "Don says the rescue team got on it right away. Then the Rangers heard visitors saying something about gunshots, so they notified the local police. Even at that point, Don's buddies didn't know it had anything to do with Jessica." "Why would they? I didn't know she was up there. Did you?" "No, but Detective Hernandez said Jessica left him a message that she was meeting Libby Vanderwart at the top of the tram. He's with the Cat City Police Department, so it took a while to put two and two together. When he heard something was going on up there, he called the Palm Springs Police Department and told them Jessica might be involved. Don said, even after that, he waited to know for sure what was going on before he called us. People were falling and guns were shooting, so there was a lot of confusion. I guess it was all over the TV by then, but nobody else called me until they gave out Jessica's name while I was talking to Don. After that, the phone calls started, so I turned off the ringer. The answering machine will take the calls, and I can listen to the voicemails later." "What was she doing up there, Bernadette? How did she get into this mess?" "She's good-hearted, but too easy to get in over her head with other people's troubles. This has to do with one of her cases, since she met Libby up there and called Detective Hernandez." "How odd. At the dinner party we held for Nick and Nora, they seemed happy with their move to the desert, and glad to have Jessica handling their legal matters. Their daughter wasn't with them for dinner that night, so I didn't realize Jessica even knew her." "There's a lot more going on. She was trying to figure it out even before Libby's friend went missing and Detective Hernandez got involved." "You're talking about that Donnelly woman. The story was on the news, but I didn't pay much attention." "Yes. Shannon Donnelly's car turned up in Cathedral City right after Thanksgiving. They found her car, but no Shannon, and nobody's seen her since. I'm betting whatever Jessica was trying to find out had something to do with that. But who knows? Libby's lucky to be alive. Her doctor, not so lucky. What was he doing up there is my question. Who was shooting? Why?" "We can ask Jessica, I hope." They lapsed into silence at that point as Bernadette sped up, driving as fast as she could to get to the hospital where the rescue squad had taken Jessica and Libby. At this point, they didn't know if Jessica could even answer anybody's questions. Hank asked no questions when Alexis called him after the briefing from the trauma doctor. Now he was making his way to the California desert as fast as he could. An architect by training and CEO of a real estate development company based in L.A., he'd spent a lot of time in Asia after the Great Recession wrecked the California real estate market. His company contracted to complete several projects in Hong Kong, Shanghai, Beijing, and Singapore after the U.S. real estate bubble burst. He'd come home to L.A. at the end of July to attend the gala for a new exhibit honoring him and other well-known architects, not just for the things that they built in Southern California, but for those never built. Designs for projects that had never gotten off the ground, so to speak, were on display. Alongside those plans were magnificent photos and artist renderings of Hank's handiwork, featuring projects that had moved from paper to brick and mortar. That included their desert modern home in the Mission Hills Country Club. The Never Built exhibit had created quite a stir, bringing Hank well-deserved attention and prospects for new projects in California. He was currently on this side of the Pacific, making travel to the hospital in Rancho Mirage simpler. Still, he was upstate, north of the Bay Area, when Alexis located him after midnight. Given the late hour, he would have to jump through a few hoops to get to Palm Springs. His corporate jet was at the airport in San Francisco. He was trying to rouse the flight crew and get them to file a flight plan. As soon as he could arrange it, a car would take him from Napa or Mendocino, or wherever he was, to the airport. No doubt, Hank had already rallied two or three colleagues or assistants to rearrange his schedule or fill in for him at events in an action-packed 12 to 14-hour day ahead. His stamina was legendary, even though he was in his mid-60s. Alexis hoped he would arrive soon. Hank was better at handling crises than she'd ever been. She reached out and took her daughter's hand in her own. That hand was so small, cold and thin. She tried not to cry or hang on too tightly as she sat at her daughter's side. As often happened, Alexis was fraught with doubt about the simplest act of mothering. The whole maternal instinct thing was a lot of hooey, as she well knew, having been reared by an icicle in a chignon and Chanel. Jessica had been such a beautiful child, so inquisitive and full of life, impulsive, too, and more energetic than Alexis ever dreamed a child could be. It had been exhausting trying to keep up with her daughter and fulfill all the expectations as Hank's wife, both in L.A. and on the local charity circuit here in the desert. Tougher still was doing all that while fighting her inner demons. She wondered if Hank had been alone at the hotel when she phoned, not that it was any of her business. Alexis, of all people, had no right to be jealous if he found pleasure in another woman's arms. Besides, that was the least of her worries. It was all too much, then and now. "Not for a Baldwin," her mother's voice chided. Emma Baldwin's stern face rose before her, lips pursed pencil thin. The woman stood, straight as an arrow, her perfect posture an angry reproach. Alexis felt her shoulders bow as she closed her eyes to make the image vanish. Her bent shoulders were, at once, concession and defiance. "Thank God for Bernadette and Hank," Alexis sighed, not even realizing she had spoken those words aloud. Jessica stirred. Alexis squeezed her daughter's hand. The stalwart Bernadette was better at handling crises, too. She was off now, searching for coffee, and Alexis hoped she would return soon. Alexis let go of Jessica's hand to scoot back in her bedside chair.
"No, no, don't let go," Jessica called out.
Alexis jumped to her feet and hung over the bed, drawing close to her daughter. A wave of dizziness flowed through her. She grabbed the rail on Jessica's bed to steady herself.
"It's okay. I'm here, baby girl. It's me, Mom. I'm right here."
Alexis spoke in soothing tones as she reached again for her daughter's hand. Tears filled her eyes with gratitude at the sound of that plaintive voice, not just because Jessica was alive, but also because she was at her side and able to comfort her beloved daughter. Alexis had not always been there when Jessica needed her, but she was now. Here was her chance to do the right thing, if only she could figure out how to do it. 2. Serendipitous events. Alexis sat as the minutes ticked by in the ICU, holding Jessica's hand. Her thoughts wavered between past and present. Sometimes, even in dire circumstances, you encounter serendipitous events. She might have been even farther away than Hank today. In July, Alexis had flown to L.A. from the Mediterranean to celebrate the Never Built event being held in Hank's honor. and had planned to leave soon after. That all changed when a routine medical exam brought Alexis worrisome news, and she headed to the Coachella Valley to get a second opinion from her previous doctor. There would be more tests before she knew what she was up against, but the doctors agreed that she had a problem. When Alexis shared what she'd learned, Bernadette was adamant that she stay put in Mission Hills, not just until she learned more about her condition, but until she made a clear decision about what to do next. Here it was, December, and she still hadn't taken the next step. Surgery. Nor had she shared the information about her condition with anyone other than Bernadette. Hired as a housekeeper decades before, Bernadette became so much more, not just in her official capacity as the household manager of the Mission Hills estate. Bernadette was a skilled coordinator of all the things it took to keep the estate running. Her skills had proved to be a lifesaver, even before Jessica's birth. The pregnancy was rough, and Alexis didn't bounce back, as everyone assured her she would, after giving birth. She tried to trudge on, but as a few years passed and Alexis's better nature yielded to the beasts within, she gave up even trying to keep up with the demands placed on her as a wife and mother. It still hurt to think about those last few years with Hank before they divorced. Hank prodded and poked at her, wondering what was wrong, but a distraction, or something like it, had become preferable to dealing with him. When you have a lot of money, diversions are plentiful and easy to come by. There was always a gala or a getaway somewhere. With all the shopping, primping, and jet-setting, sublime distractions from anything serious were within easy reach. If distraction didn't work, there was blessed oblivion. Little by little, she relied less on distraction and more on oblivion. It was easy enough to pick a fight to drive Hank away, back to their house in Brentwood and his work in Los Angeles. She often used physical pain as a cover. Tennis, horseback riding, and golf all took a toll. A headache, real or feigned, would give her an excuse to retreat to the master wing of the house and push everything away, except solitude and oblivion. Perhaps if she could have been more open about her struggles, things might have been different, but that would have meant going against the Baldwin stiff upper lip code, and it would have meant making herself vulnerable to others, including Hank. She chose not to do that. It wasn't Hank's fault. Alexis found it hard to be open to anyone, friend or family. The men in Alexis's life, a slew of them, shared her bed, but little else. That was even true for Hank, who had always wanted more from her than she could give. When he refused to settle for less, she made him leave. Bernadette was as close to a confidant as anyone in Alexis's life, but Alexis kept plenty from Bernadette. Her main regret was that Jessica took it all so hard, especially the divorce. On the verge of adolescence, Jessica had done what she could to make her anger and unhappiness clear. Racked with insecurity, doubt, and guilt, Alexis couldn't rein in her acting out. Many times, when she should have set limits or sanctioned Jessica's behavior, that image of her own mother intruded. She didn't want to kill her daughter's spirit, so she backed off. Jessica's anxious nature, the flip side of her out-of-control self, was just as hard to take. Rather than offering comfort and reassurance when Jessica was whiny and scared, Alexis felt her spine stiffen and her shoulders straighten. Her inner Emma emerged, chiding Jessica for her weakness. Occasionally, she fought her way through all the inner turmoil to connect with her daughter, but often she withdrew. In time, Bernadette became her surrogate as a mother, too, stepping in to oversee Jessica's care as well as managing household affairs. One by one, they all left Rancho Mirage, except for Bernadette. She stayed behind to manage the estate. In July, when Alexis arrived in Rancho Mirage, Bernadette helped her unpack the few things she'd brought with her. Bernadette had known that something was up. Their closeness was due to the fact it was so difficult to remain concealed in Bernadette's presence. She could read people like an open book, even a practiced deceiver like Alexis. Once the truth was out about Alexis's health, she and Bernadette had talked at length about what to do. Still, Alexis hadn't arrived at a firm sense of resolve about whether to stay in the U.S. or not. She could get the medical care she needed in Europe. Then, that afternoon in July, a few days before Hank's big event, Jessica had waltzed into the kitchen of the Rancho Mirage house. At that moment, Alexis knew she wasn't going anywhere for a while, because a while might be all she had left, and she wanted to spend that time with her daughter. She'd been tempted to tell Jessica the whole story, but the awkwardness of that moment in the kitchen had thrown her for a loop. It shook Alexis to see her daughter so apprehensive at the sight of her own mother, even though she pretended not to notice.
"Mom, what are you doing here?"
"Didn't you get my postcard? Hank's being honored, and I wouldn't miss that for the world. Let's go have lunch on El Paseo and find something scrumptious to wear," Alexis gushed, as she did so often to hide her true feelings. It all came crashing down upon her, and she rushed forward to embrace her daughter, nearly crushing Jessica.
"What is it?
What's wrong?" she'd asked, a little worrywart expression spreading over her lovely face. Alexis chickened out and kept the bad news to herself.
"It's Giovanni. We're through. I'm not going back."
That she wasn't returning to Giovanni was a truth revealed to her own heart when she blurted it out to Jessica. She would never let him see her sick. It wouldn't feel safe to be that weak around him, nor would she allow him to remember her that way.
"Oh, no. I'm so sorry," she'd said, hugging her.
"It'll be okay. You said that about divorcing Jim, and now I know you were right. You want to talk about it?" Blessed Bernadette had swept into the room then, saving Alexis from the war she was having with herself about how much to reveal to Jessica. Earlier that afternoon, she and Bernadette had decided Alexis would wait to tell the others about her health scare. She needed the test results before she knew what she faced, and with the celebration for Hank only a few days away, it would be better to wait rather than put a damper on the joyous event. The ducks all agreed she had time to consider her options and could afford to wait. There was Jessica to think about, too. It had taken Jessica months to come to grips with the reality that her marriage was over, and that was even after walking in on her faithless husband, caught in the act with the toast of Tinseltown. Alexis could have told her the guy had social climber written all over him, despite the boyish charm he used as cover. He had money of his own, and by the time he and Jessica wed, he'd acquired a position with a prestigious law firm, so he was no fortune hunter in any conventional sense. Still, it had done him no harm to insinuate himself into the circles in which the Huntingtons moved. The polished, bespoke-suited man, who turned up at a high-profile social event a few years later, was no surprise at all to Alexis. James Harper was a smooth talker and a skilled name-dropper. That wasn't the only thing she disliked about him. There was a slickness about him that made her wary, even earlier in his tennis shoes and hoodie days. He scanned the room with skill while he spoke to you. There was no way he was going to miss a chance to mix or mingle if a more important figure ventured by. That night, it had broken Alexis's heart for her daughter when Jim's wandering eye lingered on the women in the room, in particular a flashy-looking bit of arm candy from some former country of the Soviet Union. "Euro trash," Alexis had thought. "It takes one to know one." She wasn't sure what the equivalent label was for American women, but no doubt it applied to her when she joined the yachting crowd after fleeing her first marriage. From the beginning, Alexis had wanted to tell Jessica how she felt about Jim Harper, but Hank warned her off. Jim's ruthless betrayal wasn't a surprise when Jessica told her about it. Alexis hoped she hadn't seemed too cavalier about the whole thing, but she felt relieved that the slimy chameleon had shown his true colors while Jessica was still young enough to start over. What Alexis learned from Bernadette was that the nasty circumstances leading to divorce hadn't been the only traumatic events in Jessica's life that year. She'd gone through a harrowing set of encounters with thugs hired by some nouveau riche mob boss trying to move up in the underworld. Alexis had never heard of the man, even though his name appeared in the L.A. papers on numerous occasions. Later, he was implicated in the murder of Jessica's best friend's husband, Roger Stone. Even more recently, Jessica had fought for her life to evade minions dispatched by a twisted little prince of darkness who ruled over an entertainment empire. Alexis had heard of him. Poor Kelly Fontana, a frequent visitor at the Huntington house when Jessica was a teen, had the misfortune of getting mixed up with him and Jessica was dragged into the unsavory little man's realm while investigating Kelly's death, that ordeal was still fresh for Jessica when Alexis arrived in Rancho Mirage.
"Let's give her a breather for now, Bernadette,"
Alexis had said, deciding to wait before sharing more bad news. When Bernadette charged into the kitchen that afternoon in July, she took command. She sat them all down in the morning room, right off the spacious kitchen, and changed the focus from Alexis's troubles by asking Jessica to share the whole story about their adventures in sleuthing.
"Tell your mom what we did.
We're like Cagney and Lacey," Bernadette said as she filled their glasses with ice-cold lemonade that had materialized out of nowhere.
"I'm not so sure about that. More like Lucy and Ethel."
"I bet that's what Detective Hernandez thinks. He gets mad like Ricky Ricardo. He was real polite when he called to thank me for my salsa recipe. I got him wrapped up under my thumb now."
"You mean wrapped around your little finger, don't you?" Jessica asked.
"No, I said thumb. You're Lucy and I'm Ethel. I know the difference between a pinky and a thumb. I got the man right where I want him."
That sent Jessica into a fit of the giggles as she tried to explain to Alexis who Bernadette was talking about. "If you meet this guy, you'd understand why this is so funny. He's Ferdinand the Bull around Bernadette. This big, blustery detective comes barging in here, and the moment we see each other, it's like I've waved a red flag, and he's snorting and pawing at the ground. But then Bernadette charms him with her sweet smile, salsa or some other goodie, and the guy is ready to flounce among the flowers. Though I will remind you, Bernadette, he threatened to arrest you for shooting that thug in the Tresero."
"Yeah, but the last time he stopped by, he returned your dad's gun. More proof I got him right where I want him."
Alexis had a bewildered look on her face as she spoke.
"Gun? Shot him in the Tresero? Am I hearing this right, Bernadette? You shot someone in the behind with Hank's gun?"
That set off another round of laughter.
"I shouldn't be laughing, but the stealthy Meliantes who figured out how to get past the guard gate and into our backyard must have been shocked when Bernadette opened fire. The desperados were lucky that our beloved pint-sized loose cannon here only grazed one of them," Jessica said. "Lucky for her that they didn't shoot back. She won't do that again, right, Bernadette?"
Then Jessica started from the beginning and told the story of the whole dreadful ordeal surrounding Laura's dead husband, Roger. Now, in the cool December twilight of the ICU, Alexis savored the memory of that sunny July afternoon. The warmth of the golden California sun had streamed in through the semicircle of 20-foot windows that defined the area of the morning room, which was one of the most beautiful spots in the house that Hank built. The glow emanating from inside Jessica had competed with the one descending upon her by the setting sun pouring through those cathedral-like windows. In her 30s, Jessica was even more amazing than she was when she was younger. A lot of her youthful reticence vanquished, it seemed to Alexis, but what prevailed was the courage Jessica long possessed alongside the anxiety and self-doubt. Survival in the face of all the recent carnage must have made her stronger. Alexis wished she could have uttered those words that day and told Jessica how she felt. Instead, she'd said nothing. Worse than the inability to put her feelings into words was the fact that, as she sat there, that old devil, envy, crept over her. Alexis was jealous of the easy manner and open affection that passed between the two women she cared most about in the world. Envy passed, though, and the terror about being sick had fled, too. They talked for hours. As if by magic, Bernadette whipped up a glorious black bean and sweet corn frittata while the stories unfolded. Jessica had pulled out a great bottle of Pinot Grigio and poured glasses for them as she continued telling harrowing tales about tracking down killers. The story ended with her account of a rather tumultuous meeting earlier that day with the priest from St. Teresa's in Palm Springs. Jessica left that meeting perplexed by his advice. He concluded that all the shocking events in her life could be regarded as a wake-up call, one she needed to address.
"Heed the call. Look deeper into the mystery."
"Huh? The more I try to figure things out, the more screwed up my life becomes. What does he want me to do, besides give up my black Amex card?" He was clear about that. Am I supposed to wander around in the desert for 40 days and 40 nights like a penniless beggar, or sit cross-legged in the sand like a yogi contemplating my navel? Do you get it?
We've talked about putting that card away. Not that it means you need to be broke.
Just stop thinking that buying stuff will make everything better. You don't need more wandering around in the desert. That's what you've been doing since you got here. Most of the time, there's been some Meliante chasing you, and that's not your fault. Father Martin wants you to figure out a few things about your life, that's all. He gave you all those books to read, Jessica. I bet that's a good place to start. I'm not sure about the cross-legged yogurt thing, but I have a rosary you could use. That helps me be calm when I'm trying to figure out stuff.
Bernadette had been so sincere, tender, and concerned. Still, the whole priest bit rankled as Alexis listened.
There had been more, but Alexis's mind wandered. She was glad Jessica hadn't asked her what the priest meant. If she remembered him correctly, Father Martin looked more like your typical country club golf addict than a priest. There wasn't anything about him that struck her as enlightened or the least bit holy. She had little use for any priest or what he was selling. It wasn't just her Anglican bias against Catholicism, but a more general disregard for all things spiritual. She had long since lost interest in the notion that there was any master plan at work in her life, or anyone else's. The world was too big a basket case to make that believable. Even as one of the winners in a game set out to favor the 1%, she knew better. Life was a mystery, all right. Just not one worth pondering. Life's a bitch and then you die. What else was there to know? Devour life. Don't pre-digest it by ruminating like a beast lolling about in a pasture or wander about in a desert. That would have been Alexis's best advice if Jessica had asked that day. If Jessica found consolation in what the priest said, so be it.
Her conversion as a teen when she ended up at St. Teresa's after being kicked out of two other private schools in the area hadn't hurt her.
Mass couldn't be any worse for her than enjoying a concert or a good movie or some other similar form of entertainment. So Alexis had kept her views to herself. What she had shared with Jessica and Bernadette was news about her recent travels and life on the Mediterranean, avoiding any references to Giovanni. She didn't want to be questioned about ending her fourth marriage. In a matter of seconds, like her little silver Porsche sitting in the garage, Alexis had shifted into high gear. In full-blown, jet-setting socialite mode, she gushed, sharing gossip about celebrities and royals that had crossed her path in the past year. The ruse worked, although she caught glimpses of concern from Bernadette. Alexis sighed, remembering how time had passed that day. The whole afternoon, and then on into the evening, the three of them had talked. The chatter had allowed her to avoid thinking about the things she considered now as she gazed at her daughter. Her powerlessness over events weighed Alexis down. The thought of losing her daughter was far more disturbing than facing her own death. It wasn't that she feared dying so much. Oblivion was a precious thing, a state she sought through physicians and friends with some powerful drugs at their fingertips. No, death didn't worry her. The terrifying part of being sick was the thought of having to give herself over to the care of others, to let them get close whenever they needed to be close. That prospect sickened her more than the disease itself. That night in July, back in her room alone, after all that convivial chatter with Jessica and Bernadette, she'd sought escape, as she so often did, in oblivion. The doctors in her life did one thing right. They kept her well supplied with the best drugs that money could buy, making life so much easier to bear. Better living through chemistry, she had toasted aloud as she washed down a couple of sleeping pills with a swig of vodka. Managing all that good chemistry took some work. She didn't always do that so well. It also added a layer of complexity to the health issues she was facing, or not facing. She had time, they said. She would use it. As Alexis sat, clasping her daughter's hand, her mind drifted to the other great love in her life, Hank Huntington. For several nights back in July, she and Jessica stayed at the Brentwood estate, to be close to where the celebration in Hank's honor was held. When they arrived, Hank was already there, and a flood of memories had enveloped Alexis as she and Jessica crossed the threshold of the Brentwood home. Once, she and Hank were so much in love, in that house with its lovely gardens overlooking the City of Angels. Hank's dark eyes sparkled with happiness at the sight of them both. The woman Henry Huntington reflected back to her was the woman Alexis had always wanted to be. Years earlier, that look had won her heart, and it had caused her to say yes when he asked her to marry him. If only it had been enough. Even when her problems and his business had come between them, the look in his eyes reached for her across the growing chasm in their marriage. There it was, still, decades and three husbands later. She had almost broken down and told Hank about her illness. Then what? She wasn't any more prepared to depend on her ex-husband than she was to lean on Giovanni. There was so much more she didn't know about her condition. The word cancer had knocked the wind out of her, even when followed by all the assurances about early stage and high survivability rates. She'd gone for that second opinion right away and had yet another consultation scheduled in August once she returned to the desert. Then she would have a clearer picture about her options. Then she might ask Hank or Jessica for their input. So she put it off. The whirlwind of shopping, hair, face, and body treatments for the gala left little time for subsequent bouts of weakness. Even in darkness, light, Alexis thought. For a few days, they were a family again, and the celebration of Hank's accomplishments put them all in good spirits. The evening was a gala one. As usual, the L.A. weather cooperated, and much of it was held out under the stars. The courtyard area in which the ceremony took place was awash in the twinkle of thousands of tiny lights strung above their heads. A gentle breeze caused the gauzy curtains, hung to define the space, to billow. A jazz combo played, and the wailing of a sax set a cool urban vibe as the buzz of excited partygoers filled the surrounding space. Champagne flowed as a squadron of buffed and polished young servers hustled. Pretty people scurried to make sure all the other pretty people were well tended. In the darkness of the ICU, Alexis smiled, recalling how she'd been in her element that night. She and Jessica adorned in haute couture, with their hair and makeup flawless. Alexis floated through a sea of air kisses and exchanged warm greetings with old friends and acquaintances. She promised to call, have lunch, or meet up at some subsequent event. Alexis had appeared at ease. A happy, no, make that an ecstatic member of the 1%, untouched by life's travails. Superficial inquiries as to one's health and well-being met with superficial replies. Wonderful, darling, absolutely wonderful. So kind of you to ask. And you? Alexis was masterful, keeping the conversation light. Compliments flew as if there were the slimmest possibility that a moment might turn serious. You look fabulous, darling. Love your dress and your hair. Who did it? Here and there, a flirty glance or whispered comment suggested more might come of the evening for some. For the most part, there was no expectation of deeper truth, nothing exposed. All relationships, even the most amiable, adeptly controlled and kept at arm's length. The years had taken a steady toll on those with whom she'd shared banalities for decades. Some in her circle were gone, but those who remained sported valiant efforts to thwart aging. Many had become almost unrecognizable because of aging combined with so many nips and tucks. She admired their fighting spirit. Do not go gentle or unremodeled into that good night, she'd thought. The building itself blazed with lights as those invited to the gala wandered through the exhibits. Besides recognizing Hank and a half a dozen architects and designers, the event was also a fundraiser for the A&D Architecture and Design Museum. Dining, dancing, and a silent auction took place that night, along with the awards ceremony. It all went off without a hitch. Hank was beaming, and Alexis performed her best Nancy Reagan version of the adoring wife, ex-wife in this case. Jessica was aglow, stunning in Giovanni couture. In the form-fitting, slinky dress, made of a draped fabric that glimmered, she might have stepped from an old Hollywood film. Paul Worthington, the handsome lawyer who hired her to work in his firm's Palm Desert office, was a stunning companion. Dressed to the nines in a bespoke tuxedo, the tall, blonde, blue-eyed man was dashing, like Robert Redford in The Great Gatsby. Smitten with Jessica,
He almost never left her side or took his eyes off her. Alexis was happy to see that Jessica enjoyed the man's company. There was a good-natured repartee between the two of them, as though they had been friends for years. Jessica's divorce was still pending, according to California law, but Alexis hoped this man might bring new happiness into her daughter's life. Alexis sighed once again at that vision of her daughter. As she stood in the half-light of the ICU, gazing upon her now, the contrast was startling. She felt a twist in the vicinity of her heart, perhaps the stirrings of something maternal.
"I should be in that hospital bed, not you," she murmured, reaching out to touch her daughter's pale face.
Voices and the sound of the door opening caused Alexis to turn as Bernadette entered the room. Two steps behind, Hank Huntington strode into the room.
3. Disneyland, anyone?
"Look who I found," Bernadette announced, whispering as she entered the hospital room.
Alexis caught her breath at the sight of the tall, broad-shouldered man who was once her husband. His dark hair, now gray at the temples, sported a classic cut. His handsome, rugged face bore a worried expression that deepened the lines age had put there. Hank wore chinos and a button-down shirt. No tie or blazer, but a bombardier jacket and sturdy, no-nonsense shoes on his feet. These were the clothes he wore when he was at a work site. Even without the mustache, something about Henry Randolph Huntington always reminded Alexis of Clark Gable. Perhaps it was his lopsided grin or the glint in his dark eyes, but neither were evident at the moment.
"How's she doing?"
he asked as he stepped toward Jessica's bedside.
"I think she's doing okay, but Nurse Andrews can tell us more after she's gone through her routine."
A nurse bustled into the room and stepped around Hank and Bernadette, reaching Jessica first. Her face was expressionless as she moved around the room checking equipment. She tugged here and there at a wire and read information displayed on machines that pinged, pulsed, and whirred. She wrote the information on a chart as she worked. Then she addressed Jessica in a clear, calm voice as she reached out and grasped her wrist. "Miss Huntington?
Jessica, wake up. We need you to wake up, hon."
Jessica's eyes fluttered open, but then closed again.
"Jessica, I know you're sleepy. We need you to wake up for a few minutes. Look, you have visitors."
Roused again, Jessica kept her eyes open longer and scanned the room. When her eyes landed on Hank, she smiled.
"Dad, what are you doing here? Are you okay? You're in a hospital."
"I'm fine, Jinx. But how about you?"
he asked, that lopsided grin on his face. Jinx was short for Jessica Alexis, a name given to her when, at age 4, she demanded to have a nickname like Hank. Later, in her tweens, using that pet name could set off a drama queen episode. She deemed it humiliating in an effort to blame her for her parents' divorce. No one blamed her, but it was a way of taking responsibility for her parents' failed relationship. She told Alexis later that it was a childish effort to find control over a situation where she had none. Now, in her groggy state of mind, hearing that name caused her to smile, but also to express alarm.
"I am a jinx, Dad. Did you know I fell off a mountain? I guess I'm okay." "Am I okay?"
she asked the nurse, struggling to focus her eyes on the woman who was bustling around again. The nurse bent over her, checking the IV site where they were pumping Jessica full of who knows what, including some damn good pain meds.
"Yes, you're okay. Remarkably well, I'd say, considering you fell off a mountain."
That comment broke through the nurse's clinical detachment, and she smiled a real smile at Jessica.
"So, she's really okay?" Alexis asked.
"Yes, I think so. Dr. Welch will be here soon. It will be his call, but I bet we'll be taking this young woman out of here." She smiled again. Jessica's eyes widened.
"Yay! Did you hear that, Bernadette? We're all going home. Isn't that good news?"
she asked, with a loopy grin on her face. Then her face brightened.
"Better tell the cat pack."
"You can't go home yet, baby girl," Alexis said, speaking in a calm voice.
"Somebody needs to turn down that drip," she added. "We don't have a cat."
"I can explain that part,"
Let's hope it's not that bump on the head that's got her all loosey-goosey, Bernadette said, as she handed Alexis a large cup of coffee.
Ooh, coffee. Oh, that is so sweet. It's just what I need.
Jessica struggled, raising an arm to make a grab for her mother's